So this is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. John Williams here, and Pete Zimmerman's the producer, and John Smallwood is the president of Smallwood Wealth Management. JohnSmallwood.com. Hi, John. You're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You advise people on their investments. You help them to retirement. Is that the idea?
That's the goal. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it does require a little input on our part as well. You know, the thing, though, that everybody, it seems, in your business is talking about these days is how inflation erodes retirement savings. I think it's very easy to overlook the urgency of that, if urgency is even the right word. Now, let's start there. What do you have to say about that?
So the urgency is that most people, when they retire, as much as they don't want to be, they're on some sort of a fixed income. They're on a fixed withdrawal rate. They may have, you know, a nice portfolio, but they're going to be taking a 3 or 4% withdrawal from those monies. And what's happening is, if inflation is 3, 4, 5, 6%, you know, within 10 years, your purchasing power is just getting destroyed. And it's causing people to take excessive risk that they shouldn't be taking. So it's time to really reassess and rethink the way you're going to approach the retirement dollars. And if you are retired, to maybe think about, you know, how are you being impacted and how can you get out of some of it?
Is there a tiger? Is there a sort of an equation that is there a possible target that whatever inflation is, the rate of return on the investment will actually equal inflation so I don't lose that ground? I mean, I'll have to take maybe withdrawals, but at least I'm not losing to inflation. Is that a thought?
That's a huge thought. And, you know, when you think back, when I started in 1990, you could get a CD that was close to 6, 7%. So if you had $1 million sitting in an account, you were making $60,000, $70,000 of interest. And inflation was in the 4 to 5% range, so you were ahead of it. Fast forward today, you're at 1% or less. And inflation last year, you know, 4.5%, 5%, depending on the actual number, you're going, you know, in reverse, plus the interest has collapsed. So you're forced into principal drawdowns.
I think that's the most frustrating thing for people, is that there's just no safe, guaranteed harbor for your money anymore.
No.
But cash loses out to inflation. I mean, where can you put your money that you just say, good, I'm good for 6%, and if inflation is 7%, I'll travel less. You know, I mean, I can manage the expenses, but I just don't want to lose on the investment, and there's really no guarantee. You put it in the bank and get 0.1%, right?
Yeah, 0.1, 0.5. And I think what we've come to, you know, doing this for as long as I have, you know, the industry is very product focused. Like, is there a product that's going to achieve that? And what we've come to in how, you know, how you understand by doing these things over and over again is that it's not about the single product, but it's putting together multiple products coming together that are going to help, you know, reduce the taxes, reduce the risk, increase the income potential. Looking at things in a different light helps you overcome these. There's no, put it in the market and that's going to help you overcome inflation. That doesn't necessarily work. It works for the last 36 months beautifully, but prior to that, or the last 4 or 5 years, but it doesn't always work.
Are you talking about a ratio in a portfolio like stocks, bonds, cash, or stocks, bonds, real estate? I mean, how do you manage that?
Yeah, and historically, you know, people would say, okay, I'm going to approach retirement. I should have 60% of my money in equities and 40% in bonds, or vice versa, right? Because I want to take low risk. But when you think about the way we're making those decisions, we're using usually historical performance. And if you look back over the last 20 years, if I had half my money, 50% of it in bonds, the rate of return on bonds over the last 20 years has been great because we've been in a declining interest rate environment. Now we're bouncing off historical lows. The probability is interest rates are going to rise. That's going to be very, very troublesome for that portion of the portfolio. And traditionally, bonds have been an income producer and a risk reduction tool. And I don't think in a rising interest rate environment, it's going to be either of those. So that's forcing people to go out and look at alternative ways to approach that.
Give me, I'm out of time here, John, but is there, you walked us up to that lip. Is there some key to that alternative? What are you talking about?
I think it's really putting together a mix. You know, there is multiple financial products that are available in the marketplace, right? And you can't say no to any particular one. You have to eliminate your opinions and your biases and look at, mm-hmm. you know, can I look at an annuity? Can I look at a life insurance policy? Can I look at the market? Can I look at real estate? Can I look at how do I organize all of these available products in a way that's going to be right for the individual, that's going to help them overcome their objectives? A lot of times it's sitting here and saying, you have all these income sources and these assets, but you're overspending. And the problem is not with your investments. The problem is the way you've got your budgets aligned.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that's a harsh reality for a lot of people. But it's one of these things you have to address it.
John Smallwood's addressing it. He's the president at Smallwood Wealth Management. Interesting today, John. Let's talk again. I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and it was an absolute fun, so thank you.
Yeah, it's good to visit with you. JohnSmallwood.com. The Business Lunch continues with Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst at Bankrate. Visit Bankrate.com. By the way, Pete, I'm looking at you. I don't have a commercial to read here, right? We take our guests right now. Good thumbs up. Hey, Ted, you're on WGN Radio. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm doing well. Hope you are, too.
I am, although I thought that the pandemic had this positive spin, that it caused us to reduce our debt. According to a Bankrate report, some 42% of us have increased our credit card debt. Is that right?
That's right. So both are true. So let me explain, because it does sound a little contradictory here. Basically, the overall trend is positive. Total credit card debt is 15% lower now than it was at the end of 2019, according to the New York Fed. So that's positive. Unfortunately, though, as you said, our recent survey revealed that 42% of people with credit card debt have added to it since the pandemic started. And I think this is really that K-shaped recovery in a nutshell. So when economists are talking about some people, their financial life is getting better, at the same time, some people's is getting worse. Basically, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. That's the kind of thing that we're seeing with respect to credit card debt.
You also broke it down demographically. The younger you are, the more likely it is that you ran up your credit card rather than paid it down?
That's right. And it looked like age 40 was a big tipping point. So we found that the people under age 40 are much more likely to have added to their credit card debt during the pandemic. And I think there's a few things that can explain that. We have, on one hand, Gen Zers and millennials being the most likely to have had their incomes affected by the pandemic, more likely to work in service industry jobs and other professions that were really hit hard by COVID. The other thing I would note is that younger adults were just more vulnerable financially to begin with. Being earlier in their careers, having less money saved up, having student loans to pay down, although they have gotten really what's going to amount to almost a two-year reprieve on federal student loan payments, which is kind of a separate point, but basically, thank goodness for all the stimulus and all the government programs, because if it wasn't for that, I think these numbers would be even worse. But yeah, there are a lot of people struggling with credit card debt, and a lot of them are young adults.
They extended forbearance on student loans again until January 31st, right?
That's right. So that'll amount to basically a two-year pause when all is said and done. And I think that highlights one of the things I'm worried about moving forward, which is that even though we've said the overall picture has brightened for many, although not all, and we have to be mindful of that, what happens next? You know, like there are still a lot of wild cards out there with respect to the Delta variant and things reopening. And I think there's a lot to be optimistic about, but I also think there are some things to be concerned about. Notably, the stimulus has basically been shut off at this point, and the expanded unemployment benefits have ended, and the eviction moratorium has ended in many locations. And what now? You know, what about people that are struggling, and what are they going to do? And that's where I would offer a few strategies. You know, one that could be really beneficial is a 0% balance transfer credit card. These were hard to get last year because lenders got really worried about risk. But now that things have gotten better, these are available. So maybe look into that. Maybe look into nonprofit credit counseling. They can give you some great advice. I'm thinking of agencies like Money Management International. Green Path is another one. Good advice. Negotiate lower payments on your behalf, lower interest rates. Mm-hmm. And also just kind of the fundamentals of, could you bring in more money? Could you take on a side hustle? Could you sell some things you don't need? Could you cut your expenses? Because the point is, credit card rates are really high, and we want to make this a priority to pay them down.
Bankrate's Ted Rossman's on the line. One last thing, Ted. You guys actually did a little, I don't know, is this a survey? How did you acquire this information that people are less comfortable talking about their credit card debt than a lot of other sensitive subjects?
That was part of a consumer survey we did. Yeah, it was pretty shocking. It goes to show that this is really taboo. We found that the only thing that people think is more sensitive than talking about their credit card debt, at least among the choices we talked about, the only thing more sensitive is your love life. So that means, in other words, you'd rather talk to people about your weight, your health, your political views, your religion, your views on masks and vaccines, and you'd rather talk about all that stuff than your credit card debt. And I do think that, you know, not that we need to broadcast our credit card situation to everybody, but I do think you at least need to talk to your spouse and your close relations about this, maybe get some advice from close friends. We certainly can't bury our head in the sand with our spouse. You know, this is a shared thing that we need to talk about.
I think adults and their adult parents, kind of, there comes a point where when you're the parent, you worry about your kids' finances when they're teenagers or young 20s and they're coming into the world and starting to make money. And maybe you counsel them, but at some point they go, well, you know what? It's my business. It's not yours. And at some point it is. That can happen for a very long time. You know, I'm not a young man anymore, and yet my parents still are concerned about how much money we're earning, how secure are we, and how are we spending our money. I think about that about my adult children, although they're much younger in their earning cycles. But it's an interesting phenomenon, isn't it?
It is. And on one hand, it may feel overbearing. But on the other hand, I'm actually encouraged anytime I hear people talking about money, because I do think that a lot of times it just feels intimidating and people hide from it. And I mean, of course, there's got to be a line somewhere, and where that line is probably depends on the person. But in general, I am a proponent of talking about money and bringing it out into the open and really focusing on the goals and the values behind it. So not to like have your eyes glaze over at some of the numbers, but rather to frame it in terms of, what do you want money to do for you? You know, mm-hmm. what are some of your goals? Mm-hmm. Is it home ownership? Is it sending your kids to college? Is it, you know, buying a new car in the next year, or whatever it is? Kind of frame it that way. And then you frame it more positively. It's like, oh, if I spent less on this, I'd have more for something else. Or if I paid down this debt, you know, then buying that dream home would be more achievable. I think framing it in the positive is helpful.
Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. Okay, Ted, let's talk again. Thanks for your time today.
I'll look forward to it. Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman's the producer, and hi again, it's John Williams. This is an interesting story. Osvaldo Montalago is on a phone line, founder and CEO of Connect Care Hero. ConnectCareHero.com is the website. Osvaldo, it's John Williams. Thanks for joining us on WGN.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm just reading a little bit about your business. Tell us what Connect Care Hero does for seniors.
Yeah, no. So Connect Care Hero helps organizations tackle social isolation by providing culturally relevant programming. So you can kind of think of us as the masterclass / even Peloton for older adults 65 plus, where older adults can find things like mariachi sessions, cooking shows, dynamic book clubs, and much more.
Is it all online then? It's not in person?
Yeah, so it's all online. It's all virtual. We do have high-tech and also low-tech options. So for those that don't have access to virtual settings, they can also jump in on audio as well.
How is that different than telling grandma or grandpa, just go to YouTube and watch a video on how to make a tamale?
Yeah, no, great. We get that all the time. So all our sessions are live. So when anyone jumps into our rooms, you're talking to someone and other people about subjects you have interest in. And so you can build this social network of groups you meet regularly with.
How do they communicate? So if I'm watching somebody live, do I get a chance to participate? Do I chat in a box with them?
Yeah, yeah. So you chat, you see people, and if you're on the audio version, you chit-chat away. And it's all being led by one of our entertainment educational vendors leading the classes.
Give me an example of a popular class you have for seniors.
Yeah, so one big popular one we have is things like, live Jeopardy classes, so sessions. So we have locations jumping in from, Florida, competing against locations in Illinois, talking about, culturally themed live Jeopardy sessions. So that's something we always get a lot of requests for there's also this competition that gets built weekly as well of them going back and forth.
You mean the state of Illinois taking on the state of Florida and whoever comes up with the answer first?
Yeah, exactly. And our vendors lead those sessions.
I noticed in a write-up about you, you said that as a member of the Latino community, it was especially difficult to leave your father in a home for senior citizens. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm a first generation Latino from Mexico. And when I came to when my dad had me at 57 years old, so in that my early 20s, I had to make that difficult decision of moving to a community, a senior living community. And I didn't know, what dementia was and whatnot. So when I moved into a community here in the Back of the Yards neighborhood, I noticed right away that, my dad was very isolated, very lonely and depressed. And although he was in a quote unquote more diverse, brown and black community, they didn't really offer things that he wanted to participate in. They were doing bingo, they were doing regular, activities that you see in senior living.
Yeah.
But what my dad really needed was more, culturally relevant things, mariachi cooking classes, things about the ranch. That's actually what he would actually wake up to and actually talk to you for hours about.
That's why I suggested cooking a tamale, because I know that was closer maybe to your family and your heritage.
Yeah.
And, you make a very interesting point. I think that there's a very vanilla cast at senior centers, and yet it can be an ethnically diverse cast of people there. So how do you accommodate them? I'm kind of surprised that somebody hasn't thought of this idea, because it seems like there's a big hole in the marketplace for you, Osvaldo.
Yeah, no, that's kind of where we're seeing a lot of, locations jumping on board and older adults jumping onto our platform, is that, there is a lack of culturally programming. I think, I always say that, the space is changing. Obviously, there's more people going to senior living communities, home centers, even older adults living at home. And it's not the same, picture we thought about 10, 20 years ago, which is more white, Caucasian, affluent community, older adults. It's a diverse group coming in, and the programming is kind of a little behind.
Osvaldo Montalongo is a Chicagoan and the founder of this Connect Care Hero program or platform. Would individuals watch it at their home? My parents still live at home. They're senior citizens. They could use this. So do they just dial in? And how do you monetize it for you? How do you make money on this?
Yeah, so we primarily work with organizations like senior living communities, home health organizations, and we license out our platform. But we do have, for in the case older adults that live at home, we do have a free weekly class we provide. All they have to do is go to www.connectcarehero.com, go to our family sign-up page, our individual page, and just provide basic information. They can get access to email or text-based invitations, and we follow up with them and provide them, their preferences as well. So it's pretty simple, not too hard. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't have, high IQ when it comes to technology, we do offer, an audio-based version of our solution.
Yeah, I get that. But then is the revenue stream for you, then people do pay, though, for some classes like Masterclass?
Yeah, so right now we're just offering for free. So for any individual who wants to jump in, they can jump in for free. So this is a good time to just, get to have options, especially when not everyone can go outside. We right now primarily just do B2B organizational licensing. So right now the individuals can sign up for free and enjoy.
Hmm. Well, good for you, sir. I wish you success. And I don't know that free offer is going to be there forever. I don't think it has to be. I think this
not forever. Not forever. just a limited time. So.
Yeah. Well, let's introduce people to it. Osvaldo Montalongo's business is called ConnectCareHero.com. That's the website you want to go to. Let's stay in touch, Osvaldo. Well done. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you, John. Bye. Yeah,
what a good idea. Time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Oh, it's a very special day in Chicago and America, Johnny. It is National Drink Beer Day. Which, come on now, this, who are we kidding? This is Chicago. That's every day. And if you are a consumer, remember this, no farmers, no beer.
Without agriculture, we wouldn't have the barley and the hops, which are the biggest portion of the ingredients for the beer, especially barley.
That's Pete Crowley, one of the founders of Chicago's Haymarket Brewing.
I like to call myself the director of fermentation because I just get it all ready for the yeast, and then the yeast does the rest of the job.
And when it comes to the color and flavor of beer, barley pretty much runs the show.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely different varieties that different maltsters like to use, and it definitely affects the flavor of the beer.
Chicago, being the beer city it is, has seen a lot of brew pubs. Many have failed, but Haymarket has been around since 2010.
It's in the southwest corner of the Haymarket Square, is on Randolph and Halsted, where the Haymarket Square riot of 1886 occurred. And then about 4 years ago, we opened up the production facility in southwest Michigan, where we're doing our canning and kegging and large batch production. And then we are distributing throughout all of Illinois and Michigan.
2019 was Haymarket's best year. They had 100 employees.
It was just so exciting to be able to create all these jobs and work with all these people. And then 2020 happened.
And the number of employees fell to 30.
Watching the positions not be necessary anymore was a real big bummer. We're getting past this, and we'd like to start shooting back up and getting a lot more people back on board and grow back into where we were headed a couple years ago.
Good luck to Pete Crowley and Haymarket Brewing Company. And remember, as you raise a glass in honor of National Drink Beer Day today, be sure and toast the hardworking men and women who till the fields and raise the barley. We don't talk a lot about barley here because not much is grown in Illinois, but we do talk about corn and soybeans. Corn right now is giving back some of yesterday's gains, down about 6 cents a bushel, and soybeans as well, down about a dime right now. From the farm to your belly, along with the beer day thing, it's National Strawberry Cream Pie Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
So let's spend those with Amy Guth and talk about consumer confidence. Where are people's hearts about that right now, Amy?
Yeah, well, U.S. consumer confidence is down for the third straight month. A lot of that has to do with the Delta variant and extending the life of the pandemic, continuing on. So overall, though, I thought this was kind of an interesting detail. The conference board, the senior director of economic indicators for the conference board, said that even though consumer confidence is down for the third straight month, it's still high by historical standards. So we have to kind of keep it in context. But nonetheless, the index has fallen for about 20 months. So it reached about 128.9 in June. Now, some of those things are, you know, when we're talking about where people are spending, some of that is still on autos and home stuff, major appliances. We saw so much of that, but we are seeing a big retraction there. A lot of people kind of that were at home already kind of made those sort of purchases. And that's also a reflection of uncertainty. Anytime we see uncertainty, people tend to kind of rein in their spending a bit.
And also the government's giving them less money to spend, I suppose, huh?
Yeah, there's also that, right? I think a lot of eyes are right now on the Fed of kind of what the next moves are. Jerome Powell earlier saying that, you know, this inflationary period has gone on a little longer than expected. We expect that with any kind of rebound, but maybe this is going on a little longer than we expected. So I think a lot of eyes on the next moves there from the Fed.
Where's the travel industry going then?
Well, according to Boeing, Boeing's Chinese office anyway, they were predicting a much softer landing than they had kind of originally said, where this was going to be 2025 till we really saw things get back to 2019 levels. But the president of the Chinese operations said at an air show earlier today, which, you know, while we were sleeping, it was happening there. But she said that she felt like the next 2 to 3 years that the aviation market would be completely recovered, that we would see it a little bit sooner than originally feared.
And is she talking about miles traveled or aircraft built and sold?
She's kind of talking about all of it, since that's just kind of this, dog chasing its tail. It's kind of this circular sort of thing. We saw immediately, I thought a data point that was really interesting was aircraft sales and and how many carriers were taking delivery of aircraft they had previously ordered. So a lot of that, kind of all of it happened all at once as we saw tickets go down. The brakes were put on some aircraft deliveries, and that in turn hurt Boeing. So this is a pretty optimistic, rosy view. Boeing does a lot of forecasting. They usually do a kind of a 10-year out forecast every year or so. And the last one they did was pretty grim, really showing that recovery coming in much later than this. So this is hopefully good news if those predictions are correct.
No, you know, I think my prediction was bad about the marijuana business. I know that it was hot when it first started, when we first legalized marijuana recreationally, medicinally, but recreationally in Illinois. But it stayed strong, hasn't it, Ben?
It really has. And BDSA, which is a cannabis research firm that tracks these kind of sales across the country, they predict that Illinois marijuana sales will grow 80%, up to $1.8 billion this year. Also, that puts Illinois kind of at the top. Illinois and Massachusetts are outpacing the rest of the industry nationwide. So looking at that kind of month by month, the numbers are really quite big. So recreational marijuana sales in Illinois were $121.9 million in August, up from $88.8 million in January. So we can see that steady growth. July was a very big month. Part of that was, some speculation would indicate that's about Lollapalooza. That's about summer holidays. People maybe are more open to recreational marijuana. So that was a really strong month at $127.8 million. But your original hunch is spot on. And that is, this company also predicted that over the next 5 years, while we're still going to see the market grow and expand, they said it will roughly double in 5 years as more markets legalize marijuana. They also indicated that part of that kind of, there's sort of a novelty point. Then that is, you know, once people are used to having it around them, once we're not seeing that coming in from other states, when maybe it, more widely other states have legalized recreational marijuana, then we might see a little bit of a downturn, not a downturn in terms of a decrease, but it'll just sort of level off as that becomes kind of a more regular part of the culture. It's still kind of new and novel.
Good job, everybody. Good job, Illinois. We're tokening up as much. And here, this is anecdotal. I think I've mentioned this to you before. I don't know who's smoking what, when, where, but you walk or drive around the streets of Chicago, you just smell it in the air. I was in the parking lot the other day, just a parking lot, nobody around. I smell marijuana everywhere. I'm not complaining. I'm just kind of mystified. Maybe it's just me, Amy, but I seem to smell it in a lot of places.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I smelled it in the grocery store parking lot the other day. So someone was, getting stoned before they went to Juul. So, yeah, but, once it's legal, there it is.
Hey, listen, just a half minute or so left here, but we talked a lot about Portillo's and their numbers. Boy, that is a profitable company now that they want to go public, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I now that we've kind of known they were going to go public, we've heard that chatter for a while. But to really see the numbers, now that they filed the S-1 form with the SEC, we really kind of see what that's all about. And some numbers that really stuck out to me. The average Portillo store does about $7.9 million in sales. The average McDonald's does $2.9 million. And then here in Chicago, the average Portillo's does about an average of $9.1 million. So a lot of industry analysts who are watching this IPO. They say, they have a lot of really high hopes for Portillo's to perform really well.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.